It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Imagine having written more than 20 books on a subject and still feeling you're not an expert. Please meet Mudder Joffrey.
Well, there's so many vegetarian foods that I don't know in India. People call me the great expert on India. Nobody can be an expert on Indian food because it's such a large country. So I thought this time I'm just going to go around all of India, as much of India as I can, all the nooks and crannies that I've heard about but have not visited, and see what's lurking there, what good things are lurking. And this time I thought, I'm not going to fly everywhere. I'm going to go by car. And anything looks good on the road, I'm going to jump out and taste it and write about it.
I would have loved to have been on that road trip. Well, there's lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I picture a secret Mudder Joffrey Society of Indian food fans, her disciples covertly identifying themselves by flashing open their coats to reveal her first cookbook, in tatters, taped together, clutched to the heart. No one in their right mind would ever give up their copy of An Invitation to Indian Cooking, nor the 19 books that followed, covering every corner of India. Ah, but then there's her new book, Vegetarian India, A Journey Through the Best Indian Home Cooking. Mudder, it's so good to have you back.
It's wonderful to be back with you.
Yeah, I'm thinking about all the books. I lost count quite a while ago of all the books you've written. And you've talked about vegetarian eating before. But what brought you back to the subject with this one?
Well, there's so many vegetarian foods that I don't know in India. People call me the great expert on India. Nobody can be an expert on Indian food because it's such a large country. And every time you go into a little crevice of India, you find a new cuisine, new dishes. So I thought this time I'm just going to go around as much of India as I can, all the nooks and crannies that I've heard about but have not visited, and see what good things are lurking. And this time I thought, I'm not going to fly everywhere. I'm going to go by car. And anything looks good on the road, I'm going to jump out and taste it and write about it. How are people eating vegetarian food? Who is eating it? How do they serve themselves? How do they eat lunch? If they're working, do they eat in the workplace? Do they go home? And if you're an ashram and serving vegetarian Indian food, what do you serve? Is there a philosophy behind what you're serving? So all these are questions that I had, and I thought I'm going to get all the answers and present Indian vegetarian food in a very intimate manner to the American audience.
What were some of the real finds for you? I mean, the totally unexpected things.
Well, for example, I was in an area in southwestern India, in the mountains, which are very tropical. And they grow coffee in this area. They grow black pepper in this area. They have excellent honey in this area. And it's very forested, this particular area. And in the monsoon season, which is in the summer, it rains for about 4 months. So they can't really go about too much, and they have to eat what they can forage. So what kind of recipes come out of this? Wonderful mushroom recipes. I mean, they have mushrooms growing in the rainy season that are as large as dinner plates and as tiny as little dots. And they carpet the floor. They're on the trees. They're everywhere. And people do different things with the different mushrooms. The very large mushrooms they grill and have with a very light seasoning, almost like a little salsa. And the smaller mushrooms they make into different kinds of curries. So, for example, there's a wonderful curry with coconut milk. And it is so easy to make. It doesn't require many ingredients. And you can have it in the Indian way with rice or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you can also have it on toast. You know, there are other ways that are not fully Indian. You can keep your meal very simple, and that's fine. And I try and encourage people not to feel that they have to make a complete Indian meal all the time. Just use some things from the book to add to whatever you're eating.
Which makes a great deal of sense. What kind of spices are in that coconut mushroom curry?
Well, they're very simple spices like turmeric. Now, turmeric is that, you know what turmeric is. It's that yellow spice that comes from a rhizome, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. And the thing with turmeric, and all spices in India are used medicinally as well as for taste. So turmeric is an antiseptic. And it's a very good spice to know about because it's an antiseptic inside the body and outside the body. You can even rub it on a cut and it will heal the cut. Huh. And so we put turmeric. You can rub a little chili powder. You can rub a little cumin or coriander on the mushrooms and then set them aside. And then just cook it very simply in the coconut sauce. It's really a simple dish.
Sounds so easy, but it also sounds so good.
It is.
You talk about two brothers who are both jewelers. Their shops are very near each other. And you managed to lunch with them, which I think was a very lucky hit.
Yeah, they're actually three brothers, and they work together. You know, in India, families, what we call joint families, stay joint at the hip. And the families either live together or work together and have their lives together. So if they're three brothers, then their wives and children will be together a lot of the time, sometimes in the same building. And what these brothers do is they run this jewelry shop in the Taj Hotel, and they run them together, but they meet for lunch. And what they do in the shop is they have a big display case, and they will just clear it off. They put a tablecloth on it, and then food is sent from home, which the wives cook. And it is taken out of tiffin carriers, put on display on the case, and you get knives, forks, plates, and they sit down and eat on either side of the display case and talk about their day. So they would have, they're vegetarians, they would have some kind of bean dish, they would have lovely Indian whole wheat flatbreads like tortillas, but we call them chapatis, and they would have, the bean could be a chickpea dish. Then they would have a nice vegetable dish, which could be spinach or some other green. And they will have, you know, sometimes they use newfangled things like soya grains to make a dish. And they will put it all together and have it with water. The drink is always water. And it could be buttermilk, but that's it. You don't go beyond water or buttermilk. No wine, nothing like that. And then they sit together and eat. And this is one of the stores. You know, the Taj Mahal in India was the one that was attacked by terrorists.
Oh, yes, yes.
So their shop is full of bullet holes as well that they have not fixed. And they leave it there for people to see. And there was one statue of the Indian god, Ganesh, that was in there. And it was, the bullets came on all sides of it but didn't hit it. So it was there to be sold. And now they say, of course, we'll never sell it. It just sits in that corner where bullets flew all around. Yes. So I wanted to capture these things.
I was thinking about the fact that I've always thought of India and vegetarian cooking, which is the food of the Hindu culture, being so old and being probably the most sophisticated or evolved vegetarian food on the planet. But how did it begin? I have no clue as to where it came from. How did it evolve?
Well, it's a very interesting history, and I'll try and tell it to you in 1 minute. So going from 400 BC right into, let's say, 500 BC, Indians were eating everything. They were eating cow, they were eating horse, they were eating pork, they were eating peacock. There was nothing that was taboo. We had a lot of spices that grew naturally in India. We had rice very early on, like 4000 BC. We got wheat as well, which came from the Middle East. So we had rice, we had wheat, we had sugarcane, we had honey, and every kind of vegetable and meat was there. So the cuisine started evolving then. And as I said, it was not a vegetarian cuisine, no thought of a vegetarian cuisine. And the religion was not Hinduism at that time. Mm-hmm. It was a Vedic religion. And everything was written down. So we know a lot about what was being eaten and drunk and said and not said at that time. Then around 500 BC, we have Buddhism come in. And Jainism, both There was no meat eating in either one. There was no killing of animals in either one. And it was found that many, many people, in fact, all of India, was attracted to Buddhism. And I think a group of priests of the Vedic faith decided that they were losing out to these people with their new religion, newfangled vegetarian eating and vegetarian living and very Spartan life. They were losing out to them. So very soon, the religion, Hinduism, began to grow amongst these people. And with it, they started fighting for the attention of the people by bringing their own form of vegetarianism, which was much stricter than anything anybody had had. And it did not allow for the killing of the cow. Amongst the Jains, which was another religion that came up around the same time, another vegetarian religion, they wore masks on their faces so they wouldn't inhale an insect and therefore kill it. So it became much stricter. And this is the form of vegetarianism that then stayed on in India and came to the present day. But because it was so influenced by the Vedic religion and all the Ayurvedas, which talk about the food value of different foods and how you combine spices with each other for this thing or that thing, for this disease or that disease, whether foods are heating or whether foods are cooling, this was all there in the Vedic times. But this was now all adopted by all of India. So this cuisine kept developing and getting refined over time. And that, over time, produced the great vegetarian cuisine that we have in India today.
I knew it was going to be a great story.
But told very fast.
Told very fast. Yeah, you've just covered, I don't know how many thousand years very quickly. From one of the most complex countries that exists. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Madhur Jaffrey's latest book is Vegetarian India. Now, be sure to check out some of her recent vegetarian finds. She left us with recipes for green lentil curry with kale and broiled portobello mushrooms in the Kadaga style. You know where to get them, splendidtable.org. Coming up, after all that talk of Indian vegetarian, we're heading to L.A. for rock star level vegan food from Crossroads chef Tal Ronan. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today's best vegan restaurants are elegant, refined, even sometimes whimsical. At the forefront of the movement is the Los Angeles restaurant Crossroads. They serve things like porcini crusted eggplant, smoked heirloom carrot lox, and hearts of palm calamari. The founder and chef is Tal Ronan, a man who has been described as a plant-based food whisperer. He's author of a new book, Crossroads: Extraordinary Recipes from the Restaurant That is Reinventing Vegan Cuisine. Our correspondent, Joe Yonan of The Washington Post, talked to him about his vegan mission.
Hi, Tal. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
In your introduction, you write something that really interested me. As a lover of food, you say, I realized it wasn't the animal products I actually longed for, but the texture, the flavor, the heartiness, and the satisfaction. I was so glad to hear you talk about satisfaction because one of the common misconceptions about plant-based food, at least among meat eaters, is that you leave the meal still hungry. Yeah. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, a lot of people feel like they're not going to be satiated. They're not going to be happy after eating a vegan meal. And, you know, part of that is, you know, a lot of years of bland vegan cooking. I think it's really important when you're creating vegan dishes like we do, that they be familiar flavors, familiar textures. A lot of people think that a vegan meal is going to be a white, bland, squishy piece of tofu. And we don't even use tofu in the book. We don't use it at the restaurant. So creating dishes that have familiar flavors and a familiar feel and look are a great way to get people to try eating more plant-based foods. It's more approachable. It's less dogmatic. It's less scary. And that's kind of the focus of the new book.
Tal, I think one of the things that keeps some people from embracing veganism is cheese.
Yeah.
cheese seems to be the big bugaboo for a lot of vegan cooks. You've been involved with making cheese, making a vegan cheese, which I have to say from personal experience has really raised the bar. Kite Hill brand cheeses. Can you tell us how you got into it and what makes Kite Hill different?
First of all, thanks for trying it. What's different about it is it's made how cheese has always been made. Cheese has always been made from different milks, whether it was cow's milk or sheep's milk or goat's milk. We use almond milk, and we culture that almond milk like you would milk coming from animals, and we press it, we age it, and that's why you're getting that experience of cheese. And I think for the most part, before, most cheese alternatives were highly processed, you know, oils suspended in starch or soy. So we just have an amazing team that came together to create the cheeses. A Stanford biochemist, a cheesemaker from Boston, a cheesemaker from France. We have a really great team that is putting out great products. We have yogurts hitting Whole Foods this month, so it's a cultured almond yogurt. It's been really fun to be a part of that.
Tal, what are some of your favorite ways to get some of that satisfaction and textures and umami flavors that you talked about?
We stick to really great cooking techniques. So we do a lot of smoking, a lot of grilling. We do a smoked carrot lox where we'll take a heirloom carrot, smoke it over hickory, and then roast it until it's very tender and shave it thin. And it looks like a piece of Nova lox. And we put that on our bagel during our brunch with the almond, Kite Hill almond cream cheese. And we launched an all-vegan seafood tower, and people just went wild for it. You know, instead of lobster, we had lobster mushrooms from Oregon. We did our take on a clams casino where Scott Jones, our executive chef, smoked shallots, which gave the perception of bacon in the stuffing that you would have in a clam casino. Our Rockefeller has a shiitake mushroom. It's been poached in olive oil. The calamari is made out of hearts of palm that's, you know, sustainably grown. Just, you know, we're always trying new things. We're always trying to create food that you would never expect to have in a plant-based diet, and therefore you really don't miss it.
So, Tal, do you envision a time when vegan might become completely mainstream?
Absolutely. A project I've been working on for a long time now in Las Vegas at the Wynn Properties is a really telling sign of, you know, how mainstream this is becoming. I've worked with all the chefs at the Wynn and Encore to create menus that are completely plant-based. So you could go to the steakhouse, you can go to the Italian restaurant, and you get a regular menu, and then you also get the menu that I've created with the chefs there that's completely plant-based. And it's the program's over 4 years old, and it's doing great. People travel to the property just for the menus.
You can't get more mainstream than that.
No.
Tal Ronan is author of Crossroads. Joe Yonan is author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Be sure to check out Tal's recipe for spaghetti squash noche moscata. And it includes a killer recipe for walnut parmesan, no less. You can find it at splendidtable.org. While African Americans have been instrumental in shaping and defining America's food culture for centuries, their contributions were often invisible, replaced by stereotypes such as an illiterate Aunt Jemima who cooked mostly by natural instinct. Tony Tipton Martin has spent years building one of the largest private collections of cookbooks by African American authors. all the while uncovering and exploring their numerous and varied contributions. Her book, The Jemima Code, presents more than 150 of these cookbooks, from rare 19th century texts to modern classics. Contributor Noelle Carter talked with Toni about her discoveries.
Toni, it's a pleasure to speak with you today. What is the Jemima Code, and what was the inspiration for your project?
Well, first, let me say thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to be here and to bring these authors' stories to light. You know, the idea of a Jemima Code occurred to me in the process of researching the varied history of African Americans working in America's kitchens, and I discovered that they were quite a bit invisible. And so the idea of the code is that invisibility has provoked reactions from all of us throughout the years. There's just so many multifaceted ways that people react to the Aunt Jemima image, and the image was built on a myth that compiled various characteristics of African-American women into this one larger-than-life mammy-type character. And scholars are still questioning who Mammy was and what she really represented. And so the fact that a culinary stereotype, which turned into a trademark, came out of that is really what has caused this idea for me of a Jemima Code.
The book explores a number of stereotypes surrounding African-American cooking, including that, say, it's simply about soul food or that it's born out of poverty cooking. And then you blow those stereotypes up.
Yes, that is true. You know, these books represent all walks of life. They are largely African-Americans functioning in middle-class settings, whether that is their own environments when they have the resources or while they are at work. And what we're able to see there is the amazing flexibility and nimbleness of these cooks who are able to adjust between environments, from their own home, perhaps less fortunate environments in some cases, to cooking in a really opulent space with amazing ingredients, access to all of the tools and possible gadgets that one could need in the kitchen. And they did all of that working from memory. So the idea that these cookbooks stand as a representation for so, so many others that didn't have the ability to record what they were doing is pretty phenomenal. And among those characteristics that they demonstrate for us in the kitchen, besides the incredible memory, is the fact that they're able to perform what we think of as chef techniques, culinary classic technique. We can see that in the recipes that they're creating. They just don't know to call it that.
In addition to cookbooks, your collection includes related books and manuals covering such issues as catering and even servitude. One of the authors you profile, Helen Mahamat, owned her own cooking school, and she published a manual covering cooking, domestic service, and catering. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Sure. So Helen Mahamat is representative of the motive behind a lot of the cookbooks. And we can look at the publishing of those books in two ways, right? The historic representation would be that these were just people who were creating books in order to provide more servants, right? And that would be a very negative way to look at the situation.
Right.
But if we try to look at it through a more positive lens, taking the same information, we're able to see that here is a woman who, yes, she's conveying messaging to create more caterers, but she's conveying to us what she values in the kitchen and her professional values, what her work ethic is. And she conveys that in a very loving but also technical way. She's very precise. There is a culinary academy feel to her material. So it's really a wonderful view into the mind of a culinary instructor who traditionally and historically have been represented as unable to convey their competencies. Ordinarily, what we've historically known about these people is that they could cook very well, but that they could not communicate their skills beyond their immediate community. And of course, working within the oral tradition and the inability to read and write would be a hindrance. But what these books show us is that when they had the opportunity, they were quite able to convey what they knew to be their knowledge and their wisdom. And what we can see through the social arc that is created by these books, I've recorded them chronologically, but what is really wonderful about them is that they also speak to us about political and social issues of the time. So they're not just conveying their wisdom about cooking, but they're also sharing with us their passion for their communities. Women who published fundraiser cookbooks in order to build facilities for young women where they could learn cooking, but also how to vote and how to purchase land and how to raise their families and how to live more holistically. And then we can see them also educating one another in finer cooking, which they were criticized for that at some point in history as trying to cook white. And I'm troubled, really, by this idea that we have allowed color of one's skin to penetrate food and the table. The table is a place for us to enjoy one another's company and share our commonality, and yet we have used skin color as a wedge, really, at the table. And so my hope for this book, as it was for my ancestors and these authors, is that when we know more about them as individuals, we can then learn to respect them, to learn from them, to be inspired by them, and to return to the kitchen at a time when we're all being encouraged to take better control of our health by cooking for ourselves and consuming less fast and processed food.
Tony, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tony Tipton Martin is author of The Jemima Code, 2 centuries of African-American cookbooks. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Bring back fondue. I mean, with sleet outside, the temperature freezing our nether parts, and a deep need for warm community around the table, fondue is what we need. Now, I'm not talking about the gloppy treat of the 60s and 70s. Fondue is art in places like Switzerland, where writer Tim Neville met and studied with the kings of cheese. Contributor David Leet got him to discuss the ins and outs of authentic fondue.
Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
So fondue, huh?
I love it. Absolutely brilliant.
Tell me, how did you go from the idea of what we know in America as fondue to this trek all the way to Switzerland to find out the mysteries of fondue?
Well, you know, I missed out on that whole U.S. fondue thing. And, you know, I grew up in the 80s and, you know, for whatever reason, my parents weren't into the fondue thing. And so I was 18 the first time I had it. And it was in Switzerland as an exchange student. One wintry night, my host father made a fondue and I had never heard of such a thing. You know, all of a sudden our house just starts smelling like what I thought was a footlocker. I mean, it was just this horrible pungent smell. And, you know, we sat down and you know, I tried it and wow, I mean, a whole new world opened up to me. You know, maybe
so it blew you away.
Totally blew me away. Anyway, so yeah, so long story short, you know, that was 25 years ago. And then my wife and I, we got a chance to move back to Switzerland a few years ago. And there I sort of really dug in. And when we moved back to Oregon in 2011, I was determined to sort of keep that spirit alive of what I'd learned about fondue. But I realized I didn't really know that much. And so I pitched a magazine. I said, you know, I'd love to go back to Switzerland and find the old school cheese masters who could take me deep into the ways of the fondue.
And who were those cheese masters, those king of cheeses that you talk about?
Well, the main guy would be this guy by the name of Fred Fischer, or Fred Fischer, as the Swiss like to say.
Fred Fischer.
And he's this fourth generation dairyman. He had run a cheese shop in a little town outside of Bern called the Chazi, which is just cheese shop in Swiss German. What he did, which I thought was really interesting, was, you know, he's a businessman. So he's like, I've got all these cheeses, and he had cheeses that no other people had. And so he started blending them. He started taking a little bit from this one, a little bit from that one, and coming up with these recipes. And You know, by the time he was done, he had penned 50 different fondue recipes. You know, classic fondue might involve two cheeses, let's say. Well, his blends would involve seven cheeses. And one of those cheeses, like a classic fondue mm-hmm. cheese, a Gruyere cheese, he might use three different ages. And then he would start adding all these different ingredients to it, things that the Swiss would be like, why are you adding pesto, you know, to your fondue? Or wow. why are you adding whiskey? And mm-hmm. came up with all these wonderful names for his different fondues, you know, the James Bond fondue, the flambé fondue, the fireman fondue, and all these different things. So he ended up being the master who sort of taught me what it is, you know, made me the master, let's say.
Okay. So let's take a step back. Let's talk about the basic cheeses, those two cheeses that must be in there as a base.
Sure. So when you go to Switzerland, like the classic fondue is going to have a base of Gruyère and Vacherin. Mm-hmm. And Gruyere mm-hmm. is like different than, you know, what you think of like Wisconsin Gruyere. It's Le Gruyere. So it's a Gruyere cheese made sort of in the Prealp region of Switzerland. So okay. both of those cheeses come from there. So the classic recipe is what they call a moitié-moitié, so a half and half. So it's half Gruyere and half Vacherin. And then a white wine and okay. then Kirsch. But fondue is a little bit like, I guess, like biscuits or something. Like everybody has their own way
recipe.
Of making it. Which
so
I love.
Take us through making a fondue. Well, how would we do it?
The wonderful thing about today is a lot of these cheeses are actually not so difficult to get. Trader Joe's actually carries the real Gruyere. Vacherin,
imported
you have to look
Gruyere in, is what you're talking about.
It is,
right?
But they imported. Have it under their own label. But the first time I tasted it, I was like, this is the real Gruyere for sure. Mm. So you want that. And then Vacherin you have to get from usually, you know, a cheese specialty shop or like a gourmet grocer. And if you can't find Vacherin, you can use something like an Emmental cheese. Emmental has a much more neutral flavor to it. And so mm-hmm. automatically, in my opinion, your fondue is going to be stepped down just a little bit. So really try to find that Vacherin if you can. I learned how to make a fondue using the metric system. So you're going to want a scale and then like one of those glass Pyrex measuring cups with metric units on it as well. And so the key formula, and fondue is all about the formula, is 200 grams of cheese per person. That's about 7 ounces of cheese per person. But no mm-hmm. one ever eats fondue alone. So you're going to always think of it in terms of two. So roughly then 400 grams of cheese for every two people. And you want to have your cheese chopped up into small cubes or grated. Now, you want a nice fondue pot. Mine's ceramic. You just want something that's going to like help distribute the heat more evenly. And so you're going to take some garlic and you're going to rub the clove of garlic around the inside and the bottom of the pot. Just kind of smear it around. Chop up the rest, throw it in. Throw your cheese in, throw your wine in. And then ideally, you want to let that sit. This is something that Fred taught me. You want to let it sit for at least an hour. Just let it get all kind of gooey all in there before you start heating it up over a stove, about medium heat. Now, another key thing is that you want to add starch. And that's roughly 1 teaspoon of cornstarch per person. And then as you begin to heat this up, you want to use a wooden spoon with the hole in it and stir slowly in a figure eight, just kind of like easily
real lazy.
Getting it going real lazily. Yeah, exactly. Like you don't want to bring this thing to a roiling boil by any means. You just kind of want it to melt nice and slowly. And what's going to happen, and I used to panic with this, is that it begins to separate. And you're like, oh, no, I've ruined it. Take a deep breath. Just wait. And it should all come back together. Now, one of the fun things to do is to add just a little bit of Kirsch. Sometimes, you know, if I'm feeling like it, I'll have some, I'll add the cornstarch to the Kirsch and mix it in that way and add that in as everything's getting all liquidy and just kind of let that get in there. And that really gives it an aromatic kick to it, I guess. Mm-hmm. Other people will just keep Kirsch, like a nice cherry brandy, off on the side and they'll dip their square cubes of bread into the Kirsch before they dip it into the pot of cheese.
That sounds delicious.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful.
Tim, thanks for coming on the show. You have made all of us very hungry. I'm sure we're going to run off right now and get those cheeses from our local cheesemonger.
I sure hope so. Happy fondueing.
Thanks.
Tim Neville is a correspondent for Outside Magazine and a freelancer for the New York Times. David Leet's forthcoming book is Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression. Head to splendidtable.org for Tim's fondue manifesto and an accompanying video on how to make Tim's 007 fondue. Coming up, I'm talking to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time for us to connect. Now, you can get to us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can actually pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Okay, Taylor has found us, and Taylor is in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Taylor, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. So I've done something a little bit crazy, and I joined the circus.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. What are you doing with the circus?
I work in the wardrobe department, so I make sure all the performers look the way they're supposed to in their costumes before they go on stage.
This is amazing. And you're traveling. Which circus is it?
It's Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey.
Oh, boy. You went for broke, didn't you?
Yeah. Go big or go home.
So you're traveling all over the country?
Yeah, in a train.
What an adventure.
Yeah.
So are you feeding anybody at this point? And what's the food like?
Well, there is like a meal car. That we call it the pie car. And it's basically a greasy spoon type of restaurant.
Right.
But other than that, I just feed myself, which is where my question comes in.
Okay, what's the question?
Because I don't essentially have a kitchen. So I'm having a hard time making a variety of things for myself.
Okay. Let me think for a moment. Now, when you're in a town, do you have access to markets?
Yes.
All right. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me, just keeping fresh fruit with you, things that don't necessarily need refrigeration.
Right. You know. I do have a refrigerator and I do have a microwave.
Oh, all right. Wait, the world is our oyster. First of all, you can get a can of chicken broth. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of markets these days, you can buy one stalk of celery and one carrot. Do you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
One onion. Do you have pots?
Yeah.
Okay, or bowls, because we're going to cook this in the microwave.
Right, I do have those.
Good. And the other thing is maybe a can of beans. Now, they'll keep in the fridge also if you don't use them all. I like chickpeas, but it could be black beans. It could be almost anything. Small can of tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any spices around or herbs?
I usually keep sriracha on hand.
The condiment of the new century. Yes, exactly. Well, let's throw in with the sriracha, if you can find a little bit of dried basil.
Okay.
Okay. And maybe some cumin and coriander.
Okay.
All right. Chop up all the vegetables into small pieces. And do you have any butter or olive oil?
I have olive oil, yeah.
Wonderful. Okay. You're going to take a nice size bowl. And you're going to put a bit of olive oil in the bottom. You're just going to film it. And you're going to add salt and pepper to that. And you're going to put the chopped vegetables in there. And you're going to put that in the microwave on high for about 3 minutes.
Okay.
And that'll sauté a little bit. It won't brown, but it'll just sauté. And then what you're going to do is add the can of chicken broth. You're going to add half a can of the tomatoes. Break them up with your hands if they're mm-hmm. big ones. Add half a teaspoon of basil. You're going to add the sriracha to taste, and you're going to do a quarter teaspoon each of the cumin and the coriander. Oh, the beans. I forgot the beans. About a half a can of the beans. And then cover it up, cover the bowl, and put that in the microwave for about 5 minutes. Then see if it's simmering, and if it is, give it another 2 minutes. If it isn't, give it another 5 minutes. And then taste it. And see
that
what you
great.
Think. And then you can add lemon or lime. You can add different beans. You could even throw ground meat or chicken into that, too. You just want to cook it longer.
Right. Okay.
And then you can leave out the tomato, and you can put in a little milk. You see what I'm saying? You can play.
Yeah.
So that's a good basic for you to start with. And you can load up the vegetables. Any vegetable. I mean, you could have charred leaves. You could have carrots, parsnips, anything you think you might like.
Oh, cool. That's
so
great.
Okay, so we've now given you the stew for the trip.
Right.
And so let me ask you one question. What made you decide to join the circus?
I like to travel, and it just seemed like a really interesting opportunity.
It sounds like it. Is it like a big family, or is it so big that...
Yes and no. There's about 300 people on the train, so there are people that I haven't even met yet.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Well, sounds wonderful. Check in with us every so often, okay?
Sure thing.
Let us know what's happening, and if you find any good eats anywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, and have a blast.
Thanks.
You too. Bye. 800-537-5252. Ruth from Washington, D.C. wants to talk with us. Ruth, what's up?
Oh, hello, Lynn. So in August, my husband and I are moving to Rome.
Oh, what a hardship.
I know, we're so excited. So I'm hoping you can give us recommendations for what cookbooks to take with us to Rome.
Ah, now, you're going to miss your own food. You're
going to
have wonderful food there, really, and simple food in many cases.
And we'd like to take advantage of that. We understand that the selection in the grocery store, especially since we'll be mostly in small markets, will be different than what we're used to here.
Yes, it will be. But a lot of it, as you get used to it, is going to be similar. You just have to know, you know, what's the crossover, so to speak.
Right.
But I would say take cookbooks about the kind of food you like to eat day to day and the stuff you really get a kick out of experimenting with. So let's say, for instance, things like vegetables that are stir-fried, a simple, you know, maybe you roast a chicken. And then what you really love to fool around with is like Korean barbecue or, you know, something like North African pastries. Take that kind of combination with you. You don't need a lot. Now, frankly, one of the things I think would be great to have for you is a good Italian cookbook that gives you really the information and the basics.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
We're going to try to make Italian friends who will teach us to cook. But in the meantime, we'd like to be able to enjoy some
right.
of the local cuisine at home.
Now, there is a book, Maureen Fant, F-A-N-T. She's an American journalist. She lives in Rome. And she did a book on pastas and sauces with a woman who is absolutely a traditionalist. She's Italian and her name has now escaped me. But this is the classic way you would pair this kind of pasta with that kind of sauce, because pastas come from all different places in Italy, and they're different.
Right.
You know, you would not, let's put it this way, if you're going to be a classicist, a pasta from deep in the south of Italy would not be paired with a sauce that is very much a tradition in Milan. You see, now that doesn't mean it's not happening, but this might help you understand what you're looking at. And then I'm just trying to think about Rome. My gosh, I'm trying to think, who are the really good writers? Well, Marcello Hazan, who has passed on. Giuliano Bugiali, who did wonderful books. Fred Plotkin, Lydia Bastianich, Mario Batali. Okay, these are people who do wonderful recipes, very often very simple recipes, but they're going to help you understand the products, you know, what you're looking at. Their books often have photographs. And also there are bloggers, American bloggers in Rome, that'll help you out a lot.
Great. I'll make sure I find them.
Yeah, because they're going to be people who have done the exploring and are constantly finding new things. And if you possibly can, in that 7 months before you go, try to learn some of the language.
I've already started.
Wonderful. Wonderful. People respond so quickly if you use the language, even a few words and even mispronounced.
Exactly. Which is pretty much what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all do.
We're working on it.
Yeah. And when an Italian comes here, they mispronounce. But there's incredible kindness to be found. And Rome, to me, if I had to live in a city in Italy, the one I would pick would be Rome.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm so excited.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a welcoming city. It is a beautiful city. And the life, well, you'll know. So I hope that has helped you.
That has been very helpful. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You have a wonderful adventure.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Remember, you can reach us anytime, 800-537-5252. We're always hanging out on Twitter and Facebook, too. So be sure to connect with us there. This show marks the beginning of a new relationship for us with America's Test Kitchen. Starting this week, we're going to be checking in with the various personalities and experts from America's favorite cooking show. And this week, it's Doc Willoughby, the editorial director for magazines at America's Test Kitchen. Doc, it's so good to have you with us.
Hey, Lynn, it's great to be here.
Now, we're really excited about working together, and I'm going to get you to work right away.
I'm ready.
Okay. Let's talk pantries. Because this is the time of year, you know, the new year. People are kind of out with the old, in with the new. Have you got any thoughts of what we should be thinking about, directions we should take?
I do. And I think we should be going in the direction of Middle Eastern flavors. Now, one of the reasons I say that is that I've been predicting for 14 years that the next year is going to be the year of Mediterranean flavors, of Middle Eastern flavors. And but this year is going to be it. I'm confident. So I want to talk about a few ingredients that probably are familiar to many of your listeners, but maybe not to most. So we're going to start with an ingredient that I discovered so long ago, I don't even want to talk about it, when I first went to Turkey back in the late 70s. And it used to be very rare, but now you can find it in most, in any specialty shop or in many supermarkets now, and that's pomegranate molasses. This is a very simple product. It is just the juice of a slightly tart pomegranate that grows in the Middle East that's then boiled down to make a syrup, and then you add a little lemon juice and a little sugar. So it's very simple, but it has a really deep, deep, rich flavor. It's both tart and sweet at the same time, and it's got hundreds of uses. It's one of those things that, one of those ingredients, once you get it into your kitchen, you will start to find uses that you hadn't even thought of. I like to add a teaspoon of it to a vinaigrette. You can use it as a glaze for chicken or for other fowl. You can put it into a lamb stew at the end. You drop in a couple tablespoons of this. It's one of those ingredients that not only is great on its own, but it brings out other flavors and just enriches all kinds of dishes.
Yeah, you know what I realized? It's really wonderful when you make panna cotta.
Oh, yes.
Because you just stir it in and it's pretty. It's that gorgeous sort of very pale magenta. That's a nice way to put it.
That's a perfect way to put it. Pale magenta. I like that.
Yeah. And it's really a dynamite ingredient. What else?
Well, another one, this is kind of a twofer, is za'atar. Now, za'atar is a twofer because in Arabic it both stands for a certain kind of thyme that grows in the Middle East and also for the spice paste, the spice rub, that's made using that kind of thyme. So here in America we use just regular dried thyme, and then it's mixed with sesame seeds and sumac. Now, this is another reason that za'atar is a twofer, because sumac is another amazing ingredient. It's the ground-up dried red berries of a sumac bush that grows in the Middle East, and it's very tart, but also very light. So it's like, it's kind of like a flavor of lemon, but a little lighter. And it's perfect for using when you want a sour taste, but you don't want, you know, the sour taste as if it were a lemon, but you don't want the liquid. And so it's perfectly suited for using in spice rubs, and this is the most famous spice rub. It's used in za'atar. And za'atar has, again, it's one of those things that has hundreds of uses. You can put it on in some olive oil and use it to dip bread into. It's great for any kind of fowl sprinkling on top of it. Just putting it in yogurt in the morning. It's got, it's one of those things, only got really three ingredients, but it's so complex and they complement each other so perfectly. There's a reason that for hundreds of years it's been the primary spice rub in the Middle East. And we just love using it all kinds of ways.
My mouth is watering.
It should be. One thing, this is a really great thing if you have simple roasted or boiled vegetables. Sprinkle this on top of it. It takes you, 30 seconds, and you've
right.
got a really amazing dish, which is going to be a little different for most people. It's, since most people in our country aren't that familiar with za'atar, it's going to be something new and different for them, and it takes you no time at all.
So what's next?
Well, I'm going to very quickly make a case for a controversial ingredient which many people think is no good, and that is rose water. So you say rose water to many people, and they say grandma's linen closet. But that's because they've been using too much of it. If you use rose water very sparingly, it is it's sort of a romantic ingredient. It's got that floral quality, that beautiful aromaticity, and you use it just so you almost know what it is, but not quite. So don't use a tablespoon of it in your rice pudding. Use a teaspoon. And just that little trace of that sort of romantic, aromatic, floral ingredient is to me, is the essence of what Middle Eastern food is about.
Mm, I can actually smell it in my mind. Doc, thank you. Great
thank
talking
you,
with you. Doc Willoughby is editorial director of magazines at America's Test Kitchen, and he left us with a laundry list of dynamite recipes. DIY pomegranate molasses. Use that in the pomegranate glaze roasted quail. Then DIY za'atar, and that goes into roasted winter squash salad with za'atar and parsley. And finally, the rose water. How about Turkish stuffed apricots with rose water and pistachio? You can find them all at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. You have a great week. And until we meet again, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, marry the one who gives you the same feeling you get when you see food coming at a restaurant. SplendidTable.org has just about everything you will ever need. And if you love what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.